Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
With less money and fewer firefighters, departments have to use their people in the smartest and safest ways. So the next time you're speccing an apparatus, think manual and remote control monitors. Why, TFT practically reinvented radio frequency handheld controls for monitors, flowing from 15 up to 2,000 gallons per minute. Since every firefighter counts, so does every purchase. We can help maximize your team's Firestream's performance today. Visit us at www.tft.com or give us a call at 800-348-2686.
Good morning, live from Firehouse Expo in Baltimore, Maryland. This is the old Apparatus Architects, sponsored by Task Force Tips. This is Mike Wilbur along with
Tom Shand, and today we're going to have a little interaction with our audience here. Our rundown today for some of the topics we're going to talk about. Michael's going to give us a brief update on what's going on with the studies with respect to seat belts and how we're making out with that, and with the fact that we need to get some more firefighters to participate in that. I'm going to talk a little bit about how to develop a tool and equipment list for your rigs, if you're considering a combination unit like one of the favorite rigs that Brother Mike likes is that Quint apparatus or a rescue engine, what you need to do to prepare for that ahead of time. Then we're going to talk about some cases. It's a gentleman has momentarily left the room. We'll be back shortly. Mr. Keith Purdy is a cunning knowledge of the totally obvious, and that is how much your apparatus weighs and what its respective size is and how that can impact your operations either positively or negatively. Mike's going to talk a little bit about runaway rigs, and that's rigs that haven't run away from us because they don't like us. It's because we haven't done something right or some interlocks have failed. And there's recently been a couple of somewhat tragic incidents with that. And then we'll take some questions and answers from the audience. And that part of the program is where the audience will ask some very lucid questions, and we will give you some very logical answers. So moving forward, Mike, on the seatbelt study, how are we doing there, and how many brothers and sister firefighters do we have measured up so far?
Well, Tom, we have good news to report. First, the hand measuring study that was undertaken by Roger LaCour, an engineer at Pierce Manufacturing that also represents the 1901 committee, the NFPA 1901 group, and he also represents FEMA, has just written a white paper, a draft on his findings that he just got to Gordon and I recently, and we are reviewing that data. So that's one step in the right direction. The anthropometric body scanning initiative that was started months ago has now come to step two, part two, and it's come to fruition. As we speak, firefighters are being body scanned at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base at the rate of 6 to 10 a day, with the ultimate goal of body scanning at least 200 firefighters. To date, we are up to, I believe, 50 now. One of the concerns for the project is that people have volunteered, have signed up, they are called, they are interviewed, and then appointments are made. And then the principals from Total Contact actually call the participants the night before to remind them, send an email that day to remind the participants, and with all these people making appointments, we're getting a compliance rate of about 40%. And so, Tom, we have this team of 8 or 10 people that are on site at Wright-Patterson waiting for participants to do some hand measuring and then to use a body scanner, and a lot of firefighters aren't showing up, which has become a problem. And she's exhausted her list. So we need to have firefighters contact via email, www.totalcontact.com, to sign up for the seatbelt study. The hope is to have everybody measured by September and to have a draft of that report a month or two later, and then have the project wrapped up by year's end to begin the second phase of the project. So we really need your help out there. Anybody listening, if you're in the Dayton, Ohio area, or you can get to Dayton, bring your gear, call Jen Whitestone, contact her through the website, and volunteer and get measured for us. We have particular interest in not somebody like me who is just average, 5'10", 200 pounds.
Just average, Mike?
Just average, geez, Tom. You think at times I walk on the water.
You know, a couple times your wife, Allison, was telling me about how great you were and a great dad and all that stuff. Now I'm hearing just average. It's like, this might be the shortest podcast we've ever done here.
But what we need are minority firefighters, African-American firefighters, Asian firefighters, Hispanic firefighters, and female firefighters to volunteer to take part in a study so that all groups, all firefighters will be represented, Tom, in the final result.
Okay. Thanks for the update, Mike. Hey, we'd also like to, just for our listening audience here that we have out in our attending our podcast today is Jason Whitmire, who's the pumper and tanker product manager. Jason recently just participated in our podcast that we taped this morning, and with Jason's permission, we'll interact a little bit and throw some questions at him during the course of the our podcast this morning. So
yes, Jason represents KME, Kovach Mobile Equipment Supply, and also returning with us is going to be Mr. Keith Purdy. He is the National Sales Manager for American LaFrance.
So moving on down with our rundown, second thing we wanted to talk about is developing the tool and equipment list. And this is in part related to what we're going to be talking about later about the relative weight and dimensional size of your apparatus. Without question, one of the more common pieces of apparatus is purchased now on the aerial side of the market is some type of aerial device, rear-mounted or mid-mounted, that envelops and has a pump and a tank and an equipment package. And at some point, you reach the practical limitation as the proverbial 3 pounds in a one-pound bag if you're in a Quinton, or if you're trying to do a rescue engine, where you're doing 5 pounds in a 3 pound bag, it gets pretty tough to package all of that stuff to meet the customer's needs, make it so it fits the firehouse if you're in an East Coast community, and then most importantly, keep it street legal. The physical and practical size of apparatus is just about at its limit in some cases, but it really starts with developing, in my mind, the tool and equipment list of what the department intends to carry on the vehicle. The NFPA 1901 standard is a baseline standard and has a minimal amount of recommended or required equipment that sometimes is balanced and offset by if your community is under the auspices of ISO, the Insurance Services Office, where they have their own recommended equipment list. But most importantly, it's a very practical application as to what you want to carry on your unit to be able to allow you to function at the fire ground or the scene of the incident. And in a lot of cases where Michael and I go into a community and they're already wrestling with, as was mentioned earlier, whether we want a single stage or a two stage pump, and that's divided down the lines basically on how many gray hairs you have as to what you think you need to do and how much equipment you want. The other concept then becomes is what equipment load and what hose load capabilities do you want to have on the vehicle? Now, Jason, I'm sure in your position with being the pumper product manager, that there's a lot of times that you'll get some customer requests for a particular body size, maybe without any indication at all as to what they intend to carry or what they want to do with the rig. So being that you're more of a like a factory-based guy and you're supposed to be the expert to throw all this stuff back, what do you do in that case if somebody's describing that kind of vehicle but they don't give you any clue as to what they want to carry or what the kind of weights are of the equipment they want to carry?
It can be very difficult because you design that apparatus to be safe based off of some assumptions you're making. And the first thing we do is we relay back to the customer, if you don't have a list for us and you can't tell us exactly what's going on the apparatus, then we're going to use something like the NFPA numbers that are recommended. Say you've got a fairly large apparatus, so 2,500 pounds is going to be assigned to this apparatus in the weight workup based off of equipment. it's much better if the customer is able to say, look, this is exactly what we're carrying. This is how much hose is going on the truck. This is how many tools we're carrying. And now we can better design to be safer and meet your needs specifically. Most bids that we see come out and say, here's the apparatus size we want, but do not include the layout or the tools. We have worked one recently, which is one of the first ones that I've seen, for the Myrtle Beach Fire Department, where they didn't tell you anything on size of the apparatus. They did a list, and they said, this is exactly what we want to carry. You build an apparatus that will hold this.
Jason, that's a really good point. It's interesting to me, particularly if a department is going to buy a combination unit, like in the rescue engine world, and there's two fairly common scenarios. One is where they have an existing older pumper of some description and some kind of rescue vehicle, could be from a light to a medium duty unit, and their intention is to combine two units into one, and they're going to sell off the older engine and the smaller rescue and combine all of those services into one unit. The other scenario becomes people, the function or the mission of the fire department has changed to the point where now they're doing a lot more vehicle extrication or technical rescue out of that particular locale, and they determine that trying to put all their rescue stuff on a conventional triple combination pumper, they just physically run out of room, so now they want to get a rescue engine. Once they do that, they really don't have a good handle as to what they want to carry. You say, well, how much equipment do you want to carry? Or, you know, guy says, well, we're going to carry shoring. Well, you know, stabilization, cribbing material. Well, how much? You know, in some locales, they consider a milk crate full of 2x4s cut off at 18-inch, you know, things, that's fine. And other people are bringing half of a Home Depot lumber yard to you. And you see Jason's laughing for those folks that can't see him. So he, like myself, is probably every once in a while hosted somebody on a final inspection, and they showed up with the vehicle of everything they were going to load up and then found out, yo, Rennie, that's more than 2,500 pounds, and now we're in trouble.
Yeah, that or you see photos afterwards of something they put in service, and you're, like, getting a little nervous saying, you really exceeded what we had designed for here.
Right. One of the common things that your department, if your department, your apparatus committee, whomever's in charge of designing that rig can really assist the manufacturing sector is you're interviewing prospective salespeople coming in, and if they have the ability to come to your firehouse, one of the tactics that I've always employed is mainly because, you know, Mike, you can only stare at an aerial ladder so long, but I can stare at a hose bed for a long, long time. There's, before you go up into the meeting room, you know, just ask them, hey, can I take a run around the apparatus? And I'm opening every compartment door to kind of get an indication. If they're telling me this is the rig we're replacing, well, here's how much equipment is on there. And again, not to diminish the capabilities of departments, but it also helps you size up where the department's at in their process. If you open a compartment door and it looks like the California Closet Company has engaged in services with this department and everything is individually marked, mounted, labeled, that kind of sets off the expectation of where the customer is going to be coming from. On the other hand, you open up the vertically hinged compartment door and a 2.5-inch nozzle falls out at your feet, that's kind of telling you something else, all right? And when you get an idea then of how much, again, hose loads can vary widely. The NFPA standard says below a certain cubic foot body, it's 2,000 pounds, and over that, it's 2,500, plus the specified hose load. Well, you can't then go to the 1901 standard and say, well, the specified hose load really was only meant to be 1,200 feet of supply line or whatever you could jam into 55 cubic feet. One of the companies that I was associated with way back in the 80s was interesting. We were building a MAC CF pumper for a Long Island-based fire department. And back in the day, MAC did not make real heavy axles. There was nothing that they did between a 23,000-pound axle and a 29,000-pound axle. So this rig only had a 500-gallon water tank, was intermediate compartments on the left side and low side with exposed ladders on the right side. It was built and specified with a 23,000-pound rear axle. Well, when the fire department went to place the thing in service and at some point they went to weigh it, we found it weighed 27,000 some odd pounds on the back end. And I can remember the owner of the company saying in not so printable words, you know, no way could that possibly happen. You know, water doesn't weigh that much more on Long Island than it did in upstate New York. Well, we found out that the specified hose load was 1,200 feet of 3-inch, a second bed of 1,200 feet of 3-inch, another bed of 1,500 feet of 2.5, and then three more attack lines that came off that. So they had about 4,200 pounds of hose on there. Well, the engineering group there had not really ever figured that one out. So when you get into these combination units in particular, and that's right, wrong, or indifferent, that's where the market's going. When your potential apparatus salesperson shows up at your station for a meeting and he asks you for a copy of the inventory of the rig you're replacing or your wish list, you know, he's just not trying to pry into your personal business. It's not that the guy's selling rescue tools on the side and is going to show back up 2 days later with the wrecked car and say, let's tear this apart. He's trying to get in your head to find out how much equipment you want to carry. It's not uncommon at all on a rescue engine easily to push 3,500 to 4,000 pounds. And where you get into problems is on a brand new vehicle when it gets overloaded, and then the blame game starts when hopefully you haven't gotten in an accident yet and fallen into Mike's, you know, you have not become a digital photo on the Wilbur laptop computer, right, of what happened when things went south. But you find a situation where the rig's overloaded, and now what do you do? Occasion that Mike and I were involved in somewhat recently, department up in Connecticut on a less than five-year-old pumper built by a very reputable company, had a double high side compartments with a hydraulic ladder rack, had been outfitted with a rescue tool. I'm doing my equipment inventory, and my esteemed companion is doing his job on a creeper, and he's telling me the rear springs don't look too good. In fact, they're reverse arched. All right, might expect that on a 10 to 15-year-old rig. You certainly wouldn't expect that on a fairly new rig. So we do a timeout, advise the chief, probably, you know, do you have current weights on the unit? No, we don't. Well, do you have some place where you can run the front axle up on a scale, then the whole rig, then the rear, and let's find out where we're at? A lot of people will like to use, as they refer to them, as the police scales, where you're weighing each side individually. That works okay, but you have to make sure that you're on very, very flat ground. If you're off at all, those scales tend to be off a little bit, and not to diminish our brethren who wear blue uniforms and carry bullets, but we want to get some really accurate numbers here. So what happened, the moral of the story was, in this department, they found out that their pumper was over 2,000 pounds overloaded on the back end. So at that point, what do? You give up the rescue tool. That's only going to buy you a couple hundred. That's not getting you to 2,000 pounds. You give up some hose. Well, now you can't lay a supply line from A to B, and you know you don't want to run less water in the water tank. So it does make it rather dicey, and I'll let Mike comment on some of his experience with aerial ladder apparatus, but it certainly has not been uncommon at all. No matter who built it, everybody's guilty. In more cases than not, it's the fire department that caused the problem by not identifying up front how much weight and how much equipment loading they wanted to have. Every manufacturer worth their salt knows what their units are going to weigh leaving the factory on the front and the rear axle. And they'll be accurate within a couple hundred pounds, because if nothing else, they have a running history of what these units have weighed. Where we get into a lot of trouble is on overweight apparatus is when the fire department puts stuff in every nook and cranny, and their opinion becomes, in some cases rightfully so, you know, you provided the compartment space, I put the stuff in it, how come now it's overloaded? And now you get into the proverbial finger pointing, and it gets much worse when you have a chassis supplier that's one vendor, the body supplier that's somebody else, and this could be custom or commercial, and then you have entertaining the fire department. Now you've got three people in the ring, and it's a poor excuse for a tag team match, because nobody's going to win there. So, Mike, what's your experience been when you get into the ladder truck world as to what happens?
Weight is an extremely prevalent issue. Tom and I, we go around the country consulting all the time, and we haven't been to a firehouse in the last 3 years where all the trucks made all the weights on all the axles. And it becomes one of my new favorite terms, Tom, it doesn't matter until it matters. Okay, many states, the weight laws don't seem to apply to fire apparatus until you wreck. Okay, so you can be in what you feel is a bubble, and you can run down the road in overweight apparatus, and other than wearing out tires and springs and maybe not handling particularly well, you can more or less get away with it. It doesn't come back full forced and come home to roost until you wreck. And then once you wreck, one of the first things that the investigators are going to do is ask that you scale the rig. And that's when the true facts of the matter are found out, and that's going to be one of a series of very serious charges that could be leveled against the fire department and the driver. States like California has extremely rigid weight laws and rigid driving laws. Fire departments are just simply not exempt at all. They must follow the same criteria and standards and laws that everybody else has to do on the road as far as commercial vehicles and trucks. Unfortunately, the rest of the 50 states are just not so in tune or so astute. Many states exempt fire apparatus from weight laws or driving laws or inspection laws or anything else. To date, as far as I know, there are only 19 states that require fire trucks to even get inspected. In my opinion, a serious deficiency. Aerial apparatus. Obviously, we talked about this the other day, if you remember the trend. Tom had gotten a question. I want a 100-foot ladder, and I want it on a single axle. And it just doesn't exist anymore, correct?
Yeah, I mean, if you go back in history, rear-mounted apparatus in particular became very prevalent because people could no longer, when they wanted to go to the 100-foot device, a midship unit frankly became too long. As long as the height wasn't an issue, that really was the impetus back in the late 60s to develop a rear-mounted device to keep the overall length down. People could go with a little bit higher height. And back when we had aerial devices that, in some cases, very candidly, couldn't even lift their own weight fully extended at 0 degrees, you know, we didn't have the mandates that we have now where the tip loads are at a minimum of 250 pounds at the tip and then in 250 increments. And that was also back in the day when maybe, as they say, people were safer and saner, that we weren't trying to turn every aerial ladder truck into the Quint. So when you had a straight aerial, it was somewhat modest on a 29,000-pound rear axle, 30,000-pound rear axle. You could make it. You didn't have a lot of payload. But if you look at the units of that era, they had low side compartments. The ladders were exposed. You used to carry a 45-foot three-section or a 50-foot banger. That was centered under the turntable. As they say, life was good, all right? Now what happens is you interject a heavier aerial device, many times with, now it's a 4 outrigger stabilizer system versus 2. People then want to put a pump and a tank on it, and pretty soon you find out that whoever Jason's compatriot is over in the aerial division, he's probably running around KME going, where, you know, what planet did these people fall off of? Because as we had talked about on our earlier podcast, this is without a question, it is a customer and market-driven potential of what we're trying to meet the customer's needs. So a customer comes up with, in some cases, what they think their need, they have to have this. An example that I could cite to, there were a number of years ago, a department in upstate New York finally had enough money to buy their first aerial device, but because they had 1,000-gallon water tanks on their pumpers, had convinced themselves when this was going to be a Quint, the Quint had to have 1,000 gallons on it or it couldn't fight any fire. Now, every once in a while, I think you have to sit back and even prior to Dr. Phil say, let's lay down on the couch and first thing would be, have you ever seen this done before? If you haven't, maybe there's a good reason. And that maybe is a reason why you don't want to be the first or the second or the third person to go do that. Let a couple of other people, let them spend their money and find out whether this works or not. Not to diminish the capabilities of the manufacturer that built that particular rig. They built it, it met the weight standards, but when it came time on their ladder truck to carry the ladders, because it had a 1,000-gallon water tank and was taking that entire cavity underneath the bed section of the ladder, they found out that when they got to the past the engineering conference, well, by the way, you're going to have all your extension ladders are now going to have to be mounted on top of the body, and they ended up hanging them off the base section of the ladder on both sides. So now you had basically a 1,000-gallon aerial ladder truck that if you needed ground ladders, you're just going to take two guys and just throw them off on the ground. Well, the sum and substance was that truck lasted less than 10 years in service in that department because they realized it wasn't a ladder truck. It was a big pumper, or as they called it in that area, it was a TP. You know, it's a tanker pumper that that happened to have an aerial on it that didn't do anything very well. So,
I think one of the things that our listeners really need to understand, and Jason would appreciate this as well, weight matters. In the city of New York, in our fleet, we were going through brakes in springs at a clip of once a year every 6,000 miles. And the department sent down to the apparatus committee an edict that we needed to do better, and we needed to take technologies, and we needed to take the equipment and apply it and make this better. And it all had to really surround the weight issue. And the first thing that the FDNY did back in the early 80s was go from single axles to tandem axles. A, there was better weight distribution, and B, there was better braking. And then they went on to make other enhancements like anti-lock brakes and driveline retarders were standard fare. And now today, the apparatus are getting over 18,000 miles out of a set of brakes. Pictures on the internet of rear axles snapping and front axles snapping and tires out to the side have become pretty standard fare over the course of recent time because of weight issues. Ill handling apparatus, tire problems, spring problems, brake problems can all generally go back to the weight issue and how it was designed and who designed it, and then what the individual departments did after the unit was delivered as far as adding equipment. We had the pleasure of doing some consulting work for a department. What was it, on a pumper tanker they added the lights?
Actually did it on two rigs. They had very interesting. Bill, name manufacturer, 2,500-gallon top-mount tandem axle pumper tanker, all right, that was street legal. The day the manufacturer delivered it was street legal, but it was very close once they loaded it up with their equipment and their personnel. Aftermarket, they added a hydraulic generator up over the pump, and they added aftermarket a small little very modest light tower to the cab roof. They had an older unit that was severely overweight and was identified right away, all right, and we're looking at this and recommended to the chief that he weigh his other two newer units. They had a rock quarry or cement mixing batch facility pretty close to the station. They come back about 45 minutes later, Mike and I are still doing work, and everybody, I mean, it just looks like they came back from a fatal fire. What's the problem? Well, here's a unit with a 16,540-pound rated front axle, and with nobody in it, it's weighing like 17.2. All right. Now, part of it, again, you can't play the blame game here, but fire department aftermarket added that. But candidly, I mean, the light tower, a couple hundred pounds. The bottom line, it was marginal the day it showed up. So we heard in one of the classes just from utterance from a mechanic that said, whenever I meet with an apparatus guy, he's talking to another mechanic from an adjacent department. He goes, whatever they tell me the axles are, I'm telling them I'm buying one larger. Well, that becomes a mixed blessing. You know, if you over-axle the unit, you'll never be overweight, but then that creates some, occasionally, some pretty poor handling performance characteristics. And even just to go to the tires, most of us recognize that in the fire service, at least as new, Jason, let's throw it to you. If I'm coming to you and you're going to build me a rescue pumper, how many choices of brand of tires do I have from your company?
Brand-wise, you're only predominantly Michelin or Goodyear.
Okay.
So two. But when you get into tread and rating, now there's a whole bunch of different options.
Right. Very good point. And there's where, as much as every once in a while we'll make fun of a person in a volunteer department that's on an apparatus committee that the fellow works from, works for DPW. You know, my famous fictitious character is Chief Bucky J. Nutwelder. You know, you ask Bucky, he knows everything from welding to tires, engines, transmissions, and has worked in a local DPW forever, and he's the franchise. If you don't know a whole lot about tire or tread design, don't just take it that the fella says, oh, you want highway tread on the front and mud and snow in the back, and people go, yeah, that's good to go. Their individual tires and their tread and their sidewall design each will have different operating characteristics, and there's the kind of thing that you might want to go ride on somebody's fire truck that has that's going to be closely matched in design and weight before you go make, you know, the right decision. And to go to Jason's point, it's very well taken. It's Michelin or Goodyear, folks, all right? But within those two families, there's the tire tread and the sidewall design, with nothing to do with the manufacturer at all, can have a great impact over the handling characteristics of your vehicle. And if you're not familiar with that, then you want to get some help from the tire guy, and there's nothing wrong with that. An average fire department, if they're considering a foam system, for example, just wouldn't pick one out of the air by brand and say, give me this. And you'd say, why are you buying that $20,000 foam system? It sounds good. We saw it on the last three rigs. The neighbor's got it. He hasn't used it yet, but it looks like it might work. Well, before you invest in $20,000, you'd want to research that a little bit. The tires and your suspension system are the baseline components on your apparatus. And if you make the wrong decision in a tire, that doesn't cost $20,000, but that could wreck your day, literally, all right, if you have the wrong application, putting it in there. We're going to take a break here. It's Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan, the apparatus architects, live from Baltimore, Maryland, here at Firehouse Expo. We'll be back in a minute.
Help me out here. TFT has the industry's broadest line of fire suppression equipment, yet everyone thinks we're just nozzles. Sure, we've got all the fixed, selectable, and automatic handheld nozzles you'd ever want, but we also have great foam injection and application equipment, amazing manual and remote control monitors, high-flowing intake valves, and leak-proof suction hose. So if you're specking a new apparatus, go to www.tft.com or give us a call at 800-348-2686. TFT makes over 2,300 products. We're not just nozzles anymore.
All right, we're back here live from Baltimore, Maryland, the Firehouse Expo 2007. It's Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan, the apparatus architects. We're going to continue our discussion with respect to the dimensional issues on the apparatus. And here's where one of the good things that's in the NFPA 1901 standard says that there needs to be a readily identifiable placard on new apparatus, which gives the principal dimensions, the length, the height, and the width, and the carrying capability of the apparatus. That's good if you're buying a new rig. What Mike and I are finding, again, a lot of departments have overweight rigs and not even aware of it. And here's two significant areas where this can become a problem. If your department is considering changing the function of the unit, it maybe was a reasonably modestly designed triple combination pumper. The scenario is you're going out of, it's the oldest rig, you're going to take the supply line off and it's going to be the LDH carrier for the department. Well, you find out if you're throwing a 5-inch hose on there, every 100 feet of 5-inch hose, depending on brand and manufacturer, weighs somewhere between at the low end of about 86 pounds per 100. At the high end, it can run as high as about 102 or 104. So you decide you're just going to strip everything else out and just load up 2,000 feet of hose on air. You find out inadvertently you may have created a problem. I did some work for a department recently where they were considering taking an older. It was a well-beloved Mack CF chassis pumper that still had an open, unenclosed canopy, and they wanted to put a four-door enclosure on it, take the body off, which was a double low side pumper style body, and turn it into a rescue engine. So first thing I said even before I went down to meet with the people is that you probably need to get the vehicle weighed to see where we're at. I know what the unit looks like. I was familiar with it, but let's see where you're at right now. And then more importantly, dig into your deep sea scrolls over and find the original chassis manual, and let's validate and verify what the front axle and the rear axles were capable of doing. Well, what made this situation particularly tragic is this department had two of these units, one produced in 1988, one, if you can believe it or not, produced in 1990. Now, if you think about from a sanity check, in terms you always talk about improvisation or people being up on the front end of the power curve, in 1991 was when the NFPA came out, said no more backstepping it, sidestepping it, whatever. Everything's got to be four-door and fully enclosed. This department and the administration they had at the time probably defined conservative, all right? They bought one of the last units produced by this manufacturer because they didn't want a four-door cab. But now you own two of them, and the tragic thing is 88 and 90, while they were built 2 years apart, they ostensibly were twins, and they were some of the newer units in the fleet. So they're taking what they consider to be the pride of the fleet. We're going to finally put a four-door cab enclosure on it. We're going to turn this thing into a rescue engine and forget about it being a pumper. Well, in this particular case, we found out the way it sat with the axles, again, that were underneath the vehicle, right, it was within 200 pounds of the front axle load with nobody in the vehicle. Over the period of years, they had, as most people had, put SCBAs in the jump seats, an SCBA in the front for the officer, little tool compartment for the officer, had taken one of those Lazy Susans and put four spare bottles on a Lazy Susan on top of the engine box, and then to top it off, put fold-down jump seats with safety gates and two more SCBAs on top of the engine box. So it was barely street legal when they got it. They added out, we estimated, it was a little over 700 pounds of stuff to the front axle, and now you find out that while it was capable of seating six people, only two of them in front in the enclosed part of the cab, as soon as the driver got on there and he'd have to show up in a Speedo right out of the swimming pool, truck's overloaded, pumper's overloaded. Sorry about that, Mike. All right, and this is the one they're considering. It's the pride of the fleet. It goes to every parade. They had a whole trophy case of everything that's ever won and said, well, if they were ever giving you out trophies for overweight rigs, they could have retired it for you guys right here. Now what do you do? So, knowing...
Well, certainly the option of a four-door cab on this is out of the question then, correct?
Both was out of the question, because while it sometimes was possible to say, okay, the rig was sold with a 13,500-pound front axle, which now, I mean, we're putting those under two-door commercial cabs now. You wouldn't even consider building a four-door cab rig like that. You couldn't hold it up. The fact that it was, again, legal when it was built, not impossible, you know, and not within the financial means, yank the front axle out, throw a new front axle under it. But then you get to the back end, and it's got a 23,000-pound rear axle, and it weighs 22 and change, all right? Well, now you can't do anything. They want it to go to a double high side body with either enclosed ladders or a ladder rack. Well, now you would have had to replace the front axle and the rear axle. And there were a couple of people saying, well, yeah, but we really like this Max CF. Well, I do too, but I'm saying from a sanity check, gentlemen, it's 16 years old at the time, going on 17. How much money do you want to throw at this thing before you say punt? And before we even identify how much money we throw at this, to me, the staying question to ask is, how long do you want to keep this thing? No matter how much money you spend, it's like having an old car, family car that you maybe passed on down from, you know, it was the wife's car, then it became your car because you're running to and from work, and then it goes to the son, and sooner or later they come back and say it's going to cost $1,400 to fix the tranny. At what point do you either push it out the door, shoot it, and cut your losses? Well, in this particular department, they didn't have the chance, didn't have the opportunity to shoot it and cut their losses, push it out the door. It's the frontline piece out of the station. So what it meant is their entire thought process of where they thought they were going to be able to do things because they were facing some station renovations and other stuff in... And Jason made some very good points in the earlier podcast about, you know, the cost of apparatus. It was very interesting. You listen to the gentleman talk, and depending upon where you are geographically, if you're down in the Maryland, Virginia area and your apparatus is largely all tax-supported, you're generally not going to get people to pull back a whole lot, and they're going to make sure that the rigs are the way they are. I've had the fortune of doing some visitations of stations up in the central Pennsylvania area and up around Jason's area where people are still literally doing hoagie sandwich sales so they can go buy a fire truck. Well, if you're doing that, chances are you want to put a generator on it. The guy didn't start out with, Jason, can we put a 30K on there? I mean, they're looking, if they can put a 5,500-watt Honda on there, they're having a great day, you know. So it's the appreciation from knowing where you're at. And if you start doing things foolishly and even make a mistake back, in this case, you look in this department, these guys really screwed up 15 or 17 years ago. And when I presented the information saying, you've given me the weights, here's where you're at, and they go, you know, what's our solution? There weren't too many solutions to that thing other than they took all the weight, all the bolt-on stuff that was on top of the engine box to get it down to the point where they removed some weight from the front axle so at least they could continue to go out the door with four bodies on there, arguably, you know, seated but not fully enclosed. So...
Well, and I think you made another good point there. Honestly, we're in the midst of another consulting job now, and we keep finding over and over again that apparatus that was bought years ago can now come back and haunt you because the right stuff wasn't spec'd out and bought. A case in point now, Department bought a pumper tanker, what was that, a 99, 98? What year was that? 99 pumper tanker. The committee wanted a four-door custom enclosed cab. By the time it got through the funding mechanism and contracts were signed, it ended up being a two-door commercial cab. And that's okay until we move the clock ahead to 2007, where this was a very quickly developing area, and now they find a need for two stations, and they need to replace a rescue pumper. And they wanted to be able to have the ability to get more of a rescue than a pumper, rather than get a pumper and have some rescue capability with it. And by virtue of having to add another station and the fact that they only have two pumpers now, one of them being a rescue pumper, in order to get four-door fully enclosed cabs with people able to ride out safely leaving from each of these stations, they are now forced to only consider buying a pumper that has some rescue capabilities versus the opposite. Did I explain that right?
You know, for a guy that's worked with ladders for 25 and a half years, I'd give you about a B minus on that. That's not too bad.
Thank you, brother.
Right.
So what you do today as far as purchasing, specifying, ordering, acquiring may have a huge impact 5, 10, 15 years out from now. So, you know, the watchword is just be careful.
Yeah, and finish up on this topic when we talk about if your department is considering buying any kind of new fire truck, it's much more important. It's, you know, geometrically times two, if not three. You need to have your tool and equipment list. All right, if you can supply that together with, in today's technology, digital photos of compartments on your existing unit, when you go out to one of the excellent shows like we have down here in Baltimore, you see a tool and equipment layout on a vehicle, no matter who made it. And if it's something you say, geez, that's kind of like a concept that we would like to look at taking that compartmentation and dividing it up that way, then you take a digital photo of that, and that goes into your book. And as you're developing the specs for your unit, you kind of keep those things in mind. And that helps at least in part to try to keep the process on track so you don't find yourself wavering all over the place. I guess the best parallel would be, you know, if you're going in to purchase an automobile, you generally have an idea while over the period of years what people call intermediate cars. At least if you ever go rent a car recently and the guy says, would you like an intermediate? And I'm like, yeah, does this thing come with a shoehorn so I can fit me in here? But, you know, you have a sense for the general size of the vehicle that you want to buy. And I would suspect most people, if you were looking to buy a car first time out for, you know, one of your kids and you were looking to buy an intermediate or smaller, you know, rarely do you walk out of the showroom and say, well, we just bought the Suburban, because you never know. But that's the thought process or the premise that we find ourselves in the fire services. You get the guy on the committee that goes, the what if this and the what if that, and pretty soon you've designed a morphidite. And if you had six people on a committee, the most successful committees from their perspective is that every meeting you ever had, everybody left with a smile on their face because somebody got something that night or the week before. And what happens is you take the poor apparatus manufacturer, and we're just putting now 10 pounds in a 3-pound bag. And as some of the sentiments that's been coming in on the emails as a result of when we've talked about these subjects with the podcast, one that will stay with me for a long, long time was from a lieutenant in a department in Ohio that had a combination department, had a new chief, thought that straight pumpers and ladder trucks and rescues were not the way to go, bought a couple of Quints and bought three identical rescue engines, and his commentary was, it carries everything, but it doesn't do anything that we do well. And when you have that multiplied, it's tough enough to have one of those in your fleet. When you have two or your whole fleet's like that, it just takes the morale in the department and their ability to deliver the services to you and takes it and pretty much just throws it in the tank, even though the rigs are relatively new. All right, so we're going to move away we're talking about runaway rigs. Now, I know, Mike, earlier this week we talked about a lot with engine and truck placement, and I'm thinking you're trying to sandbag me here, that runaway rigs means you want the engine now not in the block and out of the way. You're looking at it to be like around a corner so you can't even see me, and I ain't feeling very happy about that. So
No, that's not the case, Tom. We really do need engines. some days.
Okay, I'm glad for you people that are listening that, make sure that if you're recording that, do not delete that, okay? Once again, do not delete that statement. It'll be the only time you'll hear Brother Wilbur say we need engines.
Okay, we have identified a problem and really have a lot more questions than we do answered, but there has been a Madrid of apparatus in the last 18 months that have arrived on scene and have all of a sudden just taken off down the street after several minutes on scene with nobody touching the apparatus, nobody around the apparatus, nobody doing anything to the apparatus. In one case out in the Midwest, it was a four-door commercial cab engine that had marked on scene to an MVA, a motor vehicle accident, and the rig had been on scene for 19 minutes, and on the 19th minute, again, the maxi brake was engaged. There were no wheel chocks, which is at this point neither here nor there in the story, but the rig on the 19th minute all of a sudden overrode the maxi brake and took off down the street and hit an ambulance for no explainable reason. To date, we were talking about it last night over dinner, and we have a couple of pretty good theories as to what happened there. But one thing to realize, we had done some testing, very unscientific, in the city of New York. We had a new Seagrave pumper, and we put it out on the front tarmac. We put the maxi brake on, and then we made it appear that we were putting it in pumps. We have to put it in drive to put it in pumps. And it didn't go into pumps, and it's in drive, and then we went to the pump panel and goosed up the governor, and then all of a sudden this apparatus at 1,500 RPMs is overriding the maxi brake. So a call went into the brake company that provided the brakes on this brand-new apparatus. The apparatus had never seen service before. So that brake company sent a representative the next day and said if the brakes were adjusted properly, it shouldn't do that. We put the truck up on a lift. He looked at the brakes. They were adjusted fine. We went out front, and we duplicated the same feat where the truck at about 1,500 RPMs just overrode the maxi brake and just went down the road. Then we decided, well, that was just a Seagrave truck. It's in New York. Let's expand the study a little bit. And so we did a variety of trucks from a variety of different manufacturers in different settings. And what we found is, and again, this very unscientific survey, that somewhere between 1,300 and 1,700 RPMs, the trucks will override the maxi brake and will take off down the road. The only truck that we couldn't get to do that was a tandem axle pumper tanker, and the theory there was is that there was probably just so much weight to override the brake, and the weight just wouldn't do it, and so it stayed put. Use wheel chocks, make sure the maxi brake's on, and I think we're really trying to reach out to the manufacturing sector here, and some of the questions I have with all the electronics in the rig, could it be a cell phone call? Could it be keying the radio mic? Could it be something electronically that could all of a sudden send these trucks down the road? And hopefully in the days and weeks ahead, we can get some answers. Certainly some of it is operator error, where the operator thought he had it in pumps or thought that the brake was on and the truck took off. But with so many trucks all of a sudden running away, certainly it can't be operator error in all the cases. And we're going to monitor that, and hopefully in future podcasts we will get some answers to those questions for you.
You know, one little thing that can be done with, obviously, the majority of apparatus being automatic transmissions, and then taking it a step further, having touch pads. We've seen it's a very inexpensive thing to put into the spec, that wherever your touch pad is located, particularly on a custom chassis rig where it can be in a bunch of different locales and in many cases laying in a flat position, to have a little flip cover put over that, that if you have it engaged, you know, you're leaving the unit in neutral, you've engaged it, you flip that cover over. It helps if anybody else inadvertently comes into the cab and they go to put, you know, their hand up on there or throw gear, lob gear back up on there to protect the touch pad from something like that happening. The scenario that Michael described, on that commercial chassis unit. It's, again, a little tough to diagnose or second guess, as they might say, but would strongly suspect that there was some pilot error involved with that, where the gentleman thought that the unit was indeed in neutral, to find out that it's not. Well, I guess you'd have to say anything's possible. The opportunities for, you know, the prevalent brand of Allison automatic transmissions that everybody in the industry uses, custom or commercial, to just have a mind of its own and decide to go into gear, possible, but highly unlikely. So you might even have to revise the old late Johnny Cochran out of the grave to go help you get the OJ scenario to get you out of that one. So there's where we're at with the rundown. If anyone has any questions for us, they'd like to fire up on anything, we'll be happy to take them at this point. All right. Otherwise, some of the other things that we would like you to consider moving forward on some apparatus-related issues is, with the NFPA standard, the 1901 standard, out for public comment. Again, when you you can go to nfpa.org and download that. It may seem to be a little bit unwieldy, and it's a very lengthy document. I believe with the standard attached to the back, it's 183 pages. So don't do what I started to do of take that and hit the download and just go right to print. You'll find out you don't have enough pages in the printer unless you've got a real good one to be able to copy all that. But save it to your desktop and start going through and reading it. This round of proposed changes of some of the things that are up for discussion will change, once again, the face of what the apparatus manufacturers have to face in terms of integrate into their apparatus. And maybe to a slight degree, for those of our listening audience that have been around for a while, prior to 1991, everybody was talking about what was going to go in the standard and the impact. And there was a goodly number of departments that were buying four-door cab rigs already. It didn't come as a shock or a surprise to anybody. Somebody buying a fire truck in 1992, I doubt there were too many people that were surprised to learn, oh my God, you mean I can't have a 24-inch rear step and you're not going to put those subway handholds on the back? You know, most people were pretty much aligned and geared up for that. In this round of the standard, where there's a whole lot of things being considered, there's a lot that could change the impact of the way the apparatus looks, and most significantly, potentially some of the apparatus costs. So,
but what kind of cost increase are we looking
Mike, that's a good question, and I don't know that I or anybody else in the apparatus industry is prepared to, you know, say that. One of the discussions, for example, is to have, quote, the black box. Well, there's a lot of different black box technology out there right now, some of which can be put on for, it'll do some things as little as $1,100, and there's some that are running upwards of $5,000 to $6,000. So I guess the parallel might be here, although it would be somewhat weak. But Jason will prep you ahead of time. Be prepared to throw in some commentary on this. When they came out with the tentative interim amendment to fully enclose hose beds, if you look at the way the industry has addressed that, it didn't tell you how to do it. It just said it needed to be done. If you go down on the showroom floor, as we did yesterday, and look at how the different apparatus manufacturers have either addressed that at their end, or maybe in some cases with the influence of the customers, you'll find there's a whole bunch of ways to skin the proverbial cat. There are some systems that everything hopefully will work. In some cases, you look at the apparatus down there of how the netting or the enclosure works over the end of, I know, one of your favorite things of all time, cross lays, all right? They can be easily released by a firefighter standing on the ground with his gloves on. There are some of them out there that do a phenomenal job, but I'd have a better chance trying to break into a safe at a bank, all right? Because now it's going to force you to stand on the running board with your protective gear on, with your SCBAs, probably have to take your gloves off because of the little clip assemblies that have been used, and they're installed at the top of the enclosure rather than at the bottom of the enclosure. So like you said, it doesn't matter till it matters, all right? If you guys operating in a ladder company have your OV all ready to go take the window and you're watching us engine guys down on the street look like the Three Stooges, and we're still trying to screw around with getting the netting untangled, or then the nozzle gets tangled in the netting because we didn't think about how the netting's going to drop out once you go to go pull the line. There's the kind of thing that we've taken the sentiment of what we were trying to accomplish, and we accomplished one thing, and we created another whole one, which goes to stepping surfaces and lighting of the stepping surfaces and all of that stuff. Now, not because he's here, but two thumbs up to most of the KME units that I've seen, and I'm assuming this netting has come from the facility. Those guys have it down. They've come up with a good system, and it's maybe because of where their client base is. People in the central Pennsylvania area were netting crosslays years ago because you normally only have to launch one of these things about once or twice, and the fire chief gets the call from the woman's insurance company that says, the only thing I saw was hose, and in most cases, Mike, they don't even know the difference between a TFT, a combination nozzle, a calves nozzle, or smoothbore. All they know is they took out the windshield in their front hood, and what are you, Mr. Fire Chief, going to do for me? So people down there have been doing it for a while. There's other jurisdictions that still aren't doing it, that just said the hell with it, you know, it's going to make our life too difficult. The manufacturers has to supply something. A couple of these systems that I've been on there, it's just like, it's created a problem even now trying to reload the hose because of the system that they went. So again, Jason, whoever in your place, if you've got a netting engineer, I want to meet that guy. He did a great job. You want like
we
to comment
some good
on it?
Experience because I was on board of a rig in my volunteer department that launched a hose, and the driver didn't notice it, and he did a lot of damage until he reached his destination. Somebody said, "You know, you're dragging hose the whole way with you." So we had some experience firsthand in house. And we looked at, the first thing we considered was we knew the industry was going to resist anything that was going to make it difficult for them to get that hose off. Understandably. When you're trying to pull that hose, the adrenaline's really up at that point, and now you're at the critical point. The engine's in front of the structure, the guy's trying to pull the hose off and go out and put the fire out. So we don't want anything to obstruct him from doing his job. So we really looked at different ways to make it easy to release, but not that easy that the hose was going to force against it and release it on its own. So different designs went in there. There's a lot of different designs out there. And like you said, there's some really good designs out there. There's some really difficult designs out there. There's also some designs out there that are designed so that when the customer takes delivery, they can remove it. Not a good idea for the customer to do. I think they just have to accept the NFPA ruling at this point and understand that don't wait for something to happen, because when it does happen, there's going to be a lot of consequences to it. Back on, you were talking about the cost impact on some of these things. There were a lot of customers that just refused to want to absorb any cost to add a crosslay cover. Something simple, on the side, not that expensive, but it could save someone's life to that pedestrian that got struck with the hose. So there's a couple things like that that are coming out in the new NFPA that are going to be another cost factor again. And probably the most significant one is going to be the tilt table testing, which you're not going to see that as the end user, but to some of the smaller manufacturers that don't have a facility that has a tilt table, it could put some of them out of business. So there's some things in that new NFPA that are really going to have an effect on our industry.
Yep, good points, and it was interesting to hear your personal perspective, I guess, because Michael and I are firefighters first, and then we go on to our other vocations in life, is that when you have an appreciation for from the engineering perspective, if you don't have that fire service experience, the parallel, Mike, we're going to throw this little bone to you here, and we'll wrap up on this. If you make it more difficult for us to deploy the hose, it's going to take a little bit longer. In some cases, we can injure somebody because it's going to take longer. Look at some of the running commentary we've done in the past talking about the aerial ladder controls at the turntable. Right? Some of these are designed for if you've got a beefy hand, you got a control in your hand. And some of these things look like you'd have to be a space alien because the handles are so small, it's like you're using a Nintendo control. And yet, all street legal meets the standard, but it's a little tough to describe in a spec. To go to Jason's point, you just say, I want cargo netting across the crosslays. Most people are not going to then detail, you know, from that point, where it's supposed to be hinged, the kind of latch, how it's supposed to flop, left to right, right to left, up or down, you know, but there's the kind of thing, again, the old picture's worth a thousand words. Take a picture of one of Jason's rigs. I'm telling you, folks, right, if you need to get the netting, they've got the system down, And some of these things are kind of Mickey Mouse. Tell your vendor who you're going to be building your fire truck. If it's not Jason, we want it to look like that. And if it's not, change it till it is.
Yeah, the controls on the aerials and towers, again, it goes back to the engineering community. Most of those folks, if not all of them, are not firefighters, and they really get shocked when we show them how we use the trucks and continue to contend that there's just a giant disconnect from the end user to the person in the little cubicle drawing this stuff, some of these ideas up. Some of the controls on aerial and tower ladders, if you're in International Falls, Minnesota in February with a pair of gloves on and it's 20 below zero, they're almost blatantly unsafe and would become very difficult to deploy the aerial using these little controls with any degree of safety, trying to negotiate around wires and trees and everything else that you have to do on the fire ground. Well, then you take the gloves off, and now you've got frostbite hands and try to accomplish the same task. So I think there needs to be, and it's great to have Jason here, and then even in our other podcast, to have the manufacturers interact with us so that we can kind of decrease this giant disconnect that's out there and get more on the same page.
Well, we'd like to thank all our listeners for the time today. Once again, Mike and I are very privileged to be here for many, many years running to instruct and teach various aspects of apparatus design and placement here down in Baltimore at Firehouse. I'd like to thank very much our audience for listening in today, for the folks that were here in attendance at the show, and once again, and particularly for Jason, who hung in, and it's always great to have a fellow manufacturer. We can, every once in a while, Mike, maybe the two of us, we can gang up on you later, and we'll talk some shop. So, all right, thank you very much. Appreciate your time, and I'd like to once again thank Task Force Tips for overseeing and for advertising and helping us get our message out to our listeners here, Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand, the apparatus architects from Firehouse in Baltimore, Maryland.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.